Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show with Mike Guardia. Mike is a military historian. He's a U.S. Army veteran, an award-winning author of so many books, I can't count anymore. He's also one of our Big Blend experts, and I encourage you to go to his website, mikeguardia.com, and also check out his books on Amazon. But today, you know, we're really excited to chat with you, Mike, and welcome to our new format here.
Awesome.
I know, it's great to see you finally, you know, after all these years. And Nancy says hi. And normally Nancy's on the shows, but she is doing something with dogs and she's keeping them quiet. But anyway, you know, very excited because this is someone we wanted to talk about. Last year we were in Lancaster County, in Pennsylvania, in Amish country, and you know, going checking out covered bridges and everything, but we were at Lancaster Ridge Bed and Breakfast, and Susan Rimmel, the innkeeper, said, well, you must go to this park and you must go to that park. And we found it was beautiful. Fall colors were slowly coming in. But she said, in Ephrata is where she was. There was a park and it was named after, and there's a memorial for Mr. Winters, General Winters. And Richard Davis, known as Dick Winters, and he was an officer in the U.S. Army and definitely a very decorated war veteran. And he has a memorial inside this park. And he used to live, like, when he was a kid, like when he between 8 and 10 years old, live right around the corner from this park, which is also, it's got his statue. Where the sculpture is actually like the duplicate of the one they did honoring him for D-Day and overseas. So it was really cool to see this, but then they also have a memorial trail, which is an old rails to trails program, which I'm a huge fan of, is when they take the old railroads, instead of just leaving them derelict, turning them into jogging and biking and cycling trails. And it's just beautiful. So anyway, we had to bring you on the show because you sent us on that story mission to go and get, well, it's generals and the generals' footsteps. But I think we're just really doing military history with you, no matter what. But his, I didn't know about the Band of Brothers, and Nancy and I are probably the only people who don't know, and now we do know. But that was a series that his story.
There's sure
books
was.
Written about him, and then I didn't know this, but that also inspired Saving Private Ryan, the movie Saving Private Ryan.
In a lot of ways, yeah. So Dick Winters, he's been an incredible inspiration for a lot of young officers. And I think he will continue to be an inspiration for many generations to come. And he really embodies the whole warrior ethos and the attitude and the culture that I think are part and parcel to that point in American history where, you know, you had a generation that grew up in the wake of the Great Depression. They were already used to a life of hardship. They were already used to a life where you had to improvise in order to be successful. And really, it was that rough and tumble upbringing, I think, for a lot of young people in America at that time that made them as resilient as they were when they went overseas to fight the Axis powers. And he's just an incredible example of what a tactical leader should be. Someone who is at one and the same time tough as nails, but also has a heart of gold.
When we learned about him, our first thought was, oh my gosh, what a connection to Hal Moore, who you've written but now 3 books on Hal Moore and you know, met him and also, you know, do speaking engagements on his leadership excellence. And
correct.
So when we were getting into his story, Nancy and I were like, oh my gosh, I wonder if they ever met. I mean, I know it's 2 different wars, right? Because, you know, Hal Moore's Korean and Vietnam, but this was, I wonder if they ever met.
You know, that is a good question. And it's not even something that I even thought of until you just mentioned it. But, you know, I can speak to one of Hal Moore's sons. I'm sure that if anyone knew of a potential meeting between those two, then yeah, it would definitely be one of Hal Moore's children. But yeah, my goodness, if they had met, I mean, just imagine the stories that they would have to share. You know, when you take a look at how they led troops in combat, you really see that they are cut from the same cloth and that they really embody the same values that I think people in any organization would look up to. You know, there are values that have made them good leaders in any of the organizations that they've led?
Well, I think what's important is they didn't just lead behind the lines. They got in to the right. action with their with their band of brothers, really. And I think even the title says that. And, you know, that becomes like lifelong family. And I think that's something Hal Moore definitely represented. And also, I bet you they did. You know, Hal Moore went to West Point and then he taught at West Point. Dick did, you know. So there was that. He went and did speaking engagements. He wasn't like a teacher there, right? He wasn't a professor there, but he did go and do speaking engagements. But did you see that list of, you know, all his medals? I mean, wow, he needs his own museum.
He sure does.
Well, I think some of his medals are in Pennsylvania. I know he lived in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And out there, they do have one of the museums have his medals and some of his writings. And so I don't know, man, I wish we could get them both together, but they're probably talking to each other up there.
You know? Oh yeah. Yeah.
But I wanted to touch on him getting into World War II, because you know, we talk about the draft, and a lot of times, if you even mention the draft in this country, first thing everyone thinks of is the Vietnam War, I think.
Right.
World War II, from what I've learned about him, he went and you know, took the draft instead of going to college at that time, and said, let me go in now while I'm really needed, and got in there, and look what he did. And he ended up on D-Day, and he became a paratrooper.
Right.
Was being a paratrooper pretty new at that point, or was it World War I as well?
It was. So the whole concept of airborne infantry was new to American forces in the late winter of 1941 and the early spring of 1942. It was a concept, ironically enough, that was inspired by the Germans and the Wehrmacht. They had their they had their own elite shock troop forces. And seeing how much these paratroopers, along with the many other combined arms facets, seeing what they had accomplished during Blitzkrieg really inspired American military planners to take notice. And they said, well, this will help us achieve victory on the battlefield in a tactical sense by helping us, really by helping us achieve what we call vertical envelopment. So we can take the enemy not only from a frontal position or take them from the flanks, but if we can deliver troops, get boots on the ground and somehow deliver them from the third dimension, that will make our ground operations that much easier. So you fast forward to about the spring of 1942. This is March, April timeframe. We start putting our own airborne forces into play. We start going through the testing and development of said forces in places like Camp Tocoa in Georgia, where we're validating what concepts work with parachutes and what concepts don't. And you have a slew of young volunteers from the growing armed forces that are volunteering for this duty. And the training was so intense and so rough that only a small percentage made it. You know, you had something to the tune of, you know, several thousand volunteers who would start the airborne training in the spring of 1942, but by the end of the summer, maybe 1,800 had made the cut.
Wow. Wow. That's, but you think about it, like, would you do it? I know you went out in tanks, you know, that's to me, that I know it's not a submarine. We've talked about that, but still, right. It's a land submarines, but you know, going out in a, you know, and saying, okay, we're going to drop down from the sky behind enemy lines. I mean, the training of that had to be like intense, but that had to be so scary to, I mean, how close do you get to your band of brothers? Or are you out in the field on your own, you know, going, uh-oh, now what, where am I?
Well, yeah, I have to say the airborne training, at least from what I have experienced of it. I mean, I went to airborne school where it was a 3-week course where you learn to make 5 qualifying jumps. And I can tell you that just the 3-week training that I had was not only very intense, but it was also very exhilarating. And I think it's that exhilaration factor that that really pushes you through the parts of the training that get exceptionally hard. But you know, I can also tell you that that the airborne forces that we have, those who go on to, you know, they don't just go to airborne school, but they go on to join the airborne divisions and the various airborne regiments that we have, that they are the most elite and they are the most highly trained airborne soldiers anywhere in the world.
Wow. And going behind lines, I mean, the enemy lines, that's kind of, excuse me, but it's ballsy. Really?
It is.
I'm sorry.
It is.
I mean, it, to me, I'd be like, oh man, you know, but I watched an interview with him and he talked about having a silk map in like sewn inside out of the seam of his pants. So if, even if he got caught, they wouldn't see the map the way they sewed it in. So was that a common practice for all the paratroopers at that time frame?
It was common to a lot of airborne units at the time. A lot of airborne commanders were exceptionally creative with ways that they could keep operational security. And a lot of them were telling themselves, okay, well, if there is an outside chance that someone gets captured, or if there's a chance that someone gets dropped into the wrong place at the wrong time, since at that point, I mean, we're talking 1943 and 1944, airborne operations weren't an exact science at the time. And they weren't quite as refined or quite as sophisticated as they are today. So miscalculating drops was a pretty common risk that you took whenever you sent airborne troopers into combat. So they said to themselves, okay, in the outside chance that somebody gets captured, or we do a misdrop and we intend to put somebody on one drop zone and they end up, you know, 30 or 20 some odd miles away in a place where they're not supposed to be, what can we do to help ensure operational security so that if somebody has information, it won't be readily compromised? And that was, the silk maps were part of that. They also knew that printing maps on silk made it a lot more resistant to the weather. So if you were dropping into enemy territory and it just so happened to be the rainy season, well, your map casing is only going to protect it so much for, you know, so many thousand miles. If you have a silk map, it's going to be weather resistant for, months and even years on end.
Okay, so if you land in, you know, this other field far away and you get your map out, you kind of need to know, like, okay, did they kind of know the map and go through that, obviously, before they dropped out of the sky and said, okay, you know, so they could kind of have some idea, okay, as they're going down. I'm just thinking, like, how fast it is for them, because in a way, like, if you think about the velocity, you don't want to go down so fast, right? You don't want to get hurt. And you don't want to be too slow because you don't want the enemies to see you. And did they do this at night, by the way?
They did it at night and also during the day. That's one of the risks that you take whenever you do daytime airborne operations, is that the parachute itself is, and by design, it has to be, it's a slow falling asset. So there is always the chance that a paratrooper is going to expose himself to enemy gunfire, because there is only so much that you can do when you're suspended from a harness and you're floating very slowly to the ground at, like, I don't know, maybe 5 miles an hour at the quickest.
Wow.
So, and that's also why, a lot of tactical airborne operations aren't really done from that high of an altitude. If you have your regular static line operations, typically you're not jumping at altitudes above 1500 feet.
Okay.
So, it's high enough to where you can get out the plane and the canopy can deploy, and, but it's low enough to where you're not going to be in the air for too long.
So he dropped down on D-Day, right? Mm-hmm. And then continued on to fight from there.
Right.
So when that happens, like D-Day, I mean, that's a huge mark in history.
Mm-hmm.
How many would go down at one time? How many would just, like, jump out and say, we're going over? Like, what do you think? I mean, is it, I'm trying to picture that, you know, I'm only learning. I'm still in school for this with you, you know? But, like, if you think about them all coming out, you know, it's like, are they going to band up together and go, okay, let's go get them over here? Or are they off on their own, almost like snipers?
No. So typically speaking, when you have paratroopers inside of an aircraft that's going to deliver them to the battlefield. They organize themselves into small little units called chocks. And typically, if we're talking about a C-47, then you're looking at maybe about 30 to 35 troopers per plane. And what they'll do is they'll line up along the inside fuselage of the plane that's going to deliver them to the battlefield. And then once the indicator light on the inside of the fuselage goes from red to green, that's the signal for everyone to start jumping out. And then they file out one by one. And there's enough of a timing separation so that two canopies don't get tangled up. And then once everyone has arrived on the drop zone, typically what you'll do is you'll have a chock leader who will have some kind of predetermined comms with another chock leader to say, hey, we're at this position on the drop zone. And then you'll have the platoons, companies, and even battalions start to consolidate at all these predetermined areas that are either going to be very close to the drop zone or maybe 2 to 3 miles out.
Wow. Wow. And you think about, like, isn't it World War I when we really started getting into air combat, you know, and to World War II, here we are dropping out of the sky. So you know, when you think about the pilots we've talked about in the books that you've written, you know, like talking about the F-14s and all of that. So they have to learn all of that, don't they?
Well, they have to learn a little bit of it. You see, every pilot, he's going to do something that's called survival, evasion, resistance, and escape training, or SEER for short. And it's essentially a course that gives him or her a foundation to what they need to do if ever they need to bail out of an aircraft. And if they find themselves in hostile territory, how they can survive and how hopefully they can make their way back to friendly lines.
Mm. So I'm just fascinated about it because it's just, it is crazy. And just like, hey, we're just going to come out, you know, and listening to him talk about this, he's just like, that's what we did, man. Like, no way. He also went on to fight in Belgium, France, Germany.
He sure did.
But then later helped actually, you know, there's that. I mean, if we look at right now in this country, we're like pulling out of Afghanistan, right? And everybody has different opinions of that. Pulling out of a region and going from, okay, we're in war to not out of war. It's not like, okay, now we just quit and walk home. That's a different deal. And he kind of helped in that effort, didn't he? Kind of that balance part.
Right. He did. So probably one of the more heartrending aspects of his duty after actual combat operations had ended was not only to establish a security force within the immediate area of where his unit was, but also having to shore up some of the refugees from the concentration camp in Landsberg, where his unit ultimately discovered many of the Holocaust survivors. As a matter of fact, if you look at, I believe it's episode 9 in the Band of Brothers series, it goes into great detail of how Dick Winter's unit, Easy Company, 1st of the 506, came upon a concentration camp. And that was that was their introduction to the broader concept of the Holocaust. Since prior to this point, they had no idea that any of this was going on. So they not only had to process those refugees, they had to hear those horror stories of what had happened to them simply by virtue of being Jewish. And, you know, not only come to grips with that, but also, you know, make sure that they receive the proper medical care and also interrogate a lot of local civilians as to what this, you know, what was this death camp? What was the slaver camp? You know, what is this whole concept of putting people in striped pajamas and sewing a Star of David on their chest?
Oh, man, I can imagine that. I mean, not knowing. Mm-hmm. So then you're telling, you know, hey, your leaders about, like, excuse me, this is what's happening, you know, going through that part. And so that's kind of, I find it interesting about what's happening now. Are we, you know, just, it's fascinating just with Afghanistan right now about, you know, what's going on and now the Taliban. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can't speak on it, but I find it like, I read, you know, you read and listen to so many reports, you don't know who, what to believe anymore. Like, what was it right or wrong? You know,
You know,
it's hard.
Yeah, it's always hard trying to secure the peace after the fighting stops. And, you know, it, and for that matter, it's even harder to, it's also pretty hard to determine when the fighting does stop, because in the traditional concepts of warfare, you don't stop until your enemy has decided that he's done, until he's decided that he doesn't want to carry on anymore. And in the case of World War II, there was a definitive endpoint. You know, we got closer to the goal line when Adolf Hitler committed suicide. And then we had an official drop dead date when his second in command ordered the German army to surrender. Mm-hmm. So for that point, at that point, it was very easy for us to determine when the conflict stopped. And I also think given the geopolitical context of the time, it was a lot easier to secure the peace afterwards, because, you know, we all knew who the aggressor was. We all knew that it was a faction that was controlling this particular country and this particular part of the world. Everyone knew who the winner was and who the loser was. And there was a party of winners that could invest their resources into rebuilding this country into a post-war state that would not cause trouble again in the same manner that it had in 1938. Mm-hmm. You know, here in Afghanistan, we have an entire different construct. You know, we have a culture that is so radically different from our own. You know, when we were fighting the Nazis in World War II, there was a little bit of cultural compatibility there, simply because, you know, it was part of Western civilization. So we had some commonalities there. Here the culture is different, the ethnicity is different, the religion is different. And, you know, if you take a look at not only Afghanistan, but the Middle East as a whole, stability has been the exception there. It has not been the rule. And there are as many reasons out there as the day is long for why that region has not been stable. But it was never going to be as clear cut defining the peace and securing the peace in Afghanistan as it was in Nazi Germany, you know, 70, almost 80 years ago.
Right. And I think it was a world war, like everyone coming together a little bit more, you know, and I think that's more. And it's interesting to me, going back to Dick Winters, here he was fighting and doing this and then trying to, you know, finish the peace part. And then he had other things he wanted to do before he got drafted or accepted the draft and went, you know, he was going to go to college and everything. And he ended up doing a lot of business. In fact, I think he was taking like the byproducts of chocolate and selling them to farmers or something. I'm like, you're giving pigs chocolate. I don't know. But anyway, but hey, Hershey's, Pennsylvania. But so he did have a business career. But basically the military and the government, you know, the greater government wanted him to continue on. And he didn't.
Right. Right. So he was actually pretty lucky in the sense that he finished college about 6 months before Pearl Harbor started. He was one of those who enlisted shortly before Pearl Harbor. And, you know, he was able to earn an officer's commission and did exceptionally well. But as time kept dragging on, you know, he found himself at a crossroads. He said, okay, well, I can either stay in the army, which he very seriously considered doing at one point, or I can get out. And, you know, he ultimately elected to become demobilized and return to civilian life. But he was reactivated during the Korean War. And that was the one where he really dug his heels into. And if you take that in context with everything that he had seen as a combat leader in World War II, he had every right to tell the army, hey, no, I've seen enough of combat. I've seen enough of war. You know, you guys had me for the better part of 4 years when I was fighting the Nazis in Europe. I really don't want to do this again. So, and as a matter of fact, when he got reactivated, he took some time out of his schedule to go to Washington, D.C. and speak to General McAuliffe, who had once upon a time been the commander of airborne forces. And he said, look, General, you know everything that I did when I was in the 506 in Europe. you know, about the, you know, about the, you know, attacks on a Brecourt Manor, you know, about the battles at Carentan, you know, about everything that I did in the broader context of Operation Market Garden. I've really seen enough of war at this point, and I don't have anything else to prove. Is there any way that I can just not do this? And McAuliffe, he appreciated his position, but he said, look, you did so well in the last war, you could at least be of some value to us in this war. So he then got orders to the 11th Airborne Division, which at that time was down at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And Winters, his first assignment therein was to be a plans and training officer. But the job was probably the worst example of a mind-numbing, busy work, bureaucratic post that you can imagine. And he volunteered for duty with the Rangers. And by God, he was prepared to go overseas and fight the communists as a Ranger. And at the 11th hour, I think he was either at Fort Lewis or it could have been Fort Ord, I don't remember which, but he was preparing to go overseas when it was brought to his attention that there was a clause in the personnel law that was governing how officers could deploy. It said, if you were a prior commissioned officer in World War II and you had combat experience in World War II, you can resign your commission by this effective date, and you can go back to being a civilian if you want.
Awesome.
And he took that.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Army was very reluctant to let him go at first. And, you know, I think for good reason, just because of how talented and how competent he was as a leader. But yeah, I mean, given everything that he had done, he certainly had nothing left to prove.
Yeah. And it's not even just, you know, something to prove. It's also so much in such a little time, like to go through, process that later is huge, you know, to go through. And I think, are you going to do it again? I see that happening now, you know, so many tours, and it's hard to have that time to breathe and process. And I think you got to have what you want to do in life. Right.
Right.
But mad respect for him, because I think, you know, the book, cause I think he wrote his story first before Steve Ambrose wrote his book. I think he had written some of like documents or something, some kind of documentation before the original book that inspired Band of Brothers came out. And I know there's other books out about him, but the fact that it lived on through books, through, you know, movies and HBO series, I think his spirit lives on, but also the story of what he did and the Band of Brothers, not just him. And I think that's the beauty of it, like what you're doing. You know, writing your books, you know, it keeps everything out in the forefront, which is important for people to know and understand and learn. Like I'm learning, you know, it's cool. I don't think I'll ever go and jump out of the sky, because that's never, no way. I'm not even good with bridges, you know, and I'm in Florida and I just did a bunch of causeways, and even those, no, it's flat, but I just, you have a mad respect for, you know, everything he's done and everyone that fought with him, you know?
Right.
So he's got 3 memorials dedicated to him now, 3 statues around the world.
I
remember with Hal Moore, you know, seeing his movie really inspired you to write about him and follow up on his story. When you saw Band of Brothers, was that one of those that you're like, okay, this is another really good one, you know, that did it right?
Yeah. It was an incredible inspiration for me to see that film. And, you know, I mean, just to see how well the actors portrayed those characters, and, you know, to also learn about what happened behind the scenes, that, you know, each of the actors who was selected to play a particular role, many of them got to meet the real life counterpart of the person that they were playing. And, you know, just the intense training that they all went through in order to make that miniseries as realistic as it was. It was incredible inspiration for me to see that, and awesome. Said, okay, this is really the way to make a war picture, you know, or in this case, to make a war miniseries. But they most certainly did it right.
Awesome. So let's talk about you. You've got like how many books are published now? I'm trying to keep up.
All righty. So as of right now, there are exactly 19 books.
Wow.
And then book number 20 is coming out on September 1st, that's Skybreak. And then October 15th is the biography on General Paul Gorman. That is the book called Danger Forward. And then November 15th, just 1 month after that, is a book called The Combat Diaries. And that is a collection of, that's a collection of short stories from World War II, all of whom follow the individual lives and service careers of about two dozen individuals, many of whom remain unknown to the greater American public.
Oh, wow.
just by way of example, there's one story in the Combat Diaries about an Army Air Corps sergeant who was shot down in a B-24, and he ended up surviving internment in three different German POW camps before the end of the war.
Wow. Wow.
So that just gives you an idea there. And then going into 2022 for the spring and summer season, you have Viper Alley, which is a combat history of the F-16 Fighting Falcon. For any of the non-Air Force types out there, Viper is a common nickname for the F-16. And then after that, shifting my focus back eastward across the Iron Curtain for a book called Red Bandit. And that is a combat history of the MiG-29.
You've just been leading such a slow, boring life, Mike.
Yeah, there's nothing too exciting here.
No, I think that is quite a slew of books, man. That is exciting. I think that's super exciting. A Skybreak, give everyone a little overview of that, since that's the next one coming out.
Yeah, okay.
Good cover, by the way. I like the cover.
Thank you. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Skybreak is a history of the 58th Fighter Squadron in Desert Storm. This was an F-15 Eagle squadron. And they hold the distinction of being the highest killing unit of the entire conflict. They shot down more enemy planes than any other air unit throughout the entire war. They had the most MiG kills, and they also had the distinction of killing the most number of MiG-29s, also having the distinction of being the unit to have the most double kills in a single unit, i.e. a pilot shooting down two or more planes throughout the duration of the war.
Wow. Wow. Well, we'll be chatting about that soon, right? Definitely.
Sure will.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on all these books. So I was he's going to have 21 books by the end of 2021, but no, you had to have 2020. I mean, you had to have 22 books, right? It's at 23 now. I can't keep up with all of it, but that's fantastic. Everyone, again, please go to mikeguardia.com. You can also listen to his interviews. Just go to bigblendradio.com, type in Mike Guardia in the search box, and also get his books out on Amazon and keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. Thanks for joining us, Mike. It's always a pleasure.
All righty, Lisa. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. Always a pleasure to be here.
Thanks.